I think even a lot of Christians have this misconception about marriage. And in fact, you'll read about it in a lot of Christian literature on marriage. Marriage is basically, here's the myth, marriage is basically a private arrangement, and its goal is the happiness of the respective spouses, husband and wife. That's what it's about. Now, that's a myth, and we're going to talk about where that myth came from, the myth of private marriage, with Alan Carlson here in the first 25 minutes of Issues Etc. today. We're coming to you live Monday. It is the 7th of February, already 1 week into the second month of the year. You can join the conversation, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. Alan Carlson will join us here in just a minute to talk about the myth of private marriage. Then at 3:30, in the second part of this first hour, we're going to hear that Super Bowl ad that was pulled by Ford, their Lincoln Mark LT pickup truck. This is a nice-looking pickup truck, by the way. It really is. You seen it? Oh, at the auto show. Well, you didn't see it last night on the Super Bowl because the ad was pulled. Snap, the organization that is has been in so much in the news during the priestly abuse scandal for the last several years in the Roman Catholic Church, and other groups objected to this ad. We'll talk about why, and we'll play the ad for you there in the second part of this first hour of Issues Etc. We also have some more audio from the National Prayer Breakfast, the president and another participant in the National Prayer Breakfast. In the second hour of the program, Dr. D. James Kennedy, we're going to be listening to his sermon this Sunday, the Coral Ridge Hour, a sermon about, well, mostly about Abraham Lincoln. Jesus gets a footnote, but mostly about Abraham Lincoln. And then in the 5 o'clock hour, we'll start out with Dr. Angus Manoogian, professor of philosophy at Concordia University, Wisconsin. We'll talk about the scientific vocation. He puts it in terms of reading the book of nature, reading God's world, science as a vocation. And then in the last half hour of the program, a recent Today Show feature on Joel Osteen, featuring a very brief snippet with a regular guest here on the program, Dr. Mike Horton of Westminster Seminary in Escondido, California. That's the lineup for today's Issues Etc. Again, our call-in numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. By the way, we're playing that audio during today's program. It's pretty much open lines for your questions and comments as well. Alan Carlson is president of the Howard Center in Rockford, Illinois. He's author of several books, including The American Way, Family Community in the Shaping of American Identity. And he's also written an article in the latest Touchstone magazine titled Five Rings and a Wedding. Alan Carlson, welcome to Issues Etc.
Good to be with you, Todd.
I started out talking about that myth of marriage as a private arrangement, the goal of which is mostly the happiness of the respective spouses. Where did that myth come from?
Well, it's sort of a standard temptation found in much of modern secular thought, that marriage is a sort of a libertarian institution. You should be free to marry. And you should be free to divorce. You know, easy in, easy out. The French Revolution, in a sense, introduced the idea. The revolutionaries of France 200 years ago decided to deconstruct marriage, which they saw as hopelessly tied to Christian teaching, and they wanted to free people to follow their passions.
And the French also spoke of marriage during that time as a basic human right, an issue of individual choice. Now, these kind of things resonate with us as modern Americans. How is that wrong?
Well, it's wrong because it fundamentally misunderstands the place of religion in what I call five concentric circles. The most important and basic one is the first one. It's the union of the married couple with their unborn children. It's what we don't think about too much these days, but it's the most important one. The community or the government on behalf of the community stands in on behalf of the unborn children, the children that are to come from that sexual union. And it's there to make sure that these two people understand what they're getting into. They understand the obligation they're taking on behalf of the whole community to create children and to rear them in a proper and good way.
All right, let's talk about each of these concentric circles. If it is a myth that marriage is basically just a thing between a man and a woman exclusively, and merely a private arrangement between the two, for pure relationship purposes. Let's talk about broadening the circle of marriage to understand it in terms of those five spheres, beginning with those children. You say born and unborn children are also a part of this vow that's made by husband and wife.
Well, in all of human history, no matter where you look, the procreation of children is always understood as the most important, never the only, but the most important purpose of marriage. That's why the institution exists. That's why everyone goes to the fuss that we go to at a wedding. It's because this is where new life comes from. And so there is, again, the first circle is the bond of parents to their children. But the second circle is the broader one of the newly married couple to their own families and to their extended kin. We see in a marriage it's the union of two families and the renewal of both of those families, again, through the potential of new human life. That's why you will go a long ways to see the marriage of a cousin or to see the marriage of a niece or a nephew, not just of your own children. Why? Because we still have this very proper sense that marriage is the bonding together of two families in a way that renews them both and gives them new life and purpose and a future.
So if we understand at least these two things at the very beginning, that when a husband and when a man and a woman come together as husband and wife, these vows pertain not only to the two individuals, but to their future progeny and to the families that already exist. Does the bond of marriage also have ramifications even beyond family?
Oh, indeed it does. I think the next circle I talk about is the circle of what I'd call the neighborhood, broadly defined. The people among whom you live, your neighbors, your friends, your co-workers, all of them, too, have an interest in seeing the stability of this sexual union, of this reproductive union. They too have a stake in its future. They have a stake in the production and proper rearing of children. They have a stake in the stability that goes with the marital sexual union, the promise of fidelity, which means that their own family members will be safe from prowling young men who are not married and not tied to one woman. There's a lot of ways in which, again, the neighborhood, the community, the people among whom you live have a vital interest in seeing that marriage regularized and held together. Because the obverse side of it is when divorce happens, the community also pays. It pays in the troubles people enter, the trauma of the divorce as it kind of filters its way through the neighborhood, shakes up other people's assumptions about what's right and what's wrong, the way children are affected by the divorces of their friends' parents. All of these testify, again, to the nature of marriage as a community event.
Since you mentioned divorce, let's pause for a moment and look at that. Nowadays, divorce is simply seen as the obverse side of the coin that is marriage. That you got marriage on one side and divorce on the other, and the two kind of necessarily go together. Is that an accurate way of seeing the relationship between marriage and divorce?
Well, certainly in a legal sense, a marriage is legally only as strong as the divorce laws that protect it on the other side. Today, by and large, in the era of no-fault divorce, the average marriage has less legal standing than the average business contract. The average business contract prevents people from getting out of the contract unilaterally. That's not true of marriage anymore. We allow a unilateral exit. Once you do that, it does undo the nature of marriage. So the answer is yes, the two are closely bound together. Easy divorce will mean weak marriage. Divorces where divorce is difficult, actually, it does mean stronger marriages.
So you talk about the no-fault divorce revolution that took place in the 60s and the 70s. Was this a direct result of that philosophical shift about marriage itself that you say can go all the way back to the French Revolution?
Oh, in part, indeed it was. The first no-fault statute was passed by the French Assembly back in the 1790s. We saw it again in the Russian Revolution when the communist Bolsheviks took over in 1917-1918. One of the first things they did was to pass a no-fault divorce statute, which undid family life across the nation, created all kinds of chaos and all kinds of problems. In our country, no fault was promised as a way of relieving the tensions and the traumas of divorce, that it was possible to make a divorce a little less traumatic for all concerned, a little happier for all concerned, and so it was just going to make it better. That was the promise. In practice, that's not how it turned out at all. Divorces are still quite nasty in many cases, in most cases. It's just they don't fight over fault anymore. They fight over the children, or they fight over the possession of the family dog or property. The fighting is still going on. It's just shifted to other segments. But independently, no fault did lead to a higher number of divorces. And I think most importantly, it undid the symbolism of seeing marriage as socially important. And a divorce is something of a crime against the social order. We threw that out completely with no fault.
We're talking with Alan Carlson, president of the Howard Center in Rockford, Illinois, author of several books, including The American Way, Family and Community in the Shaping of American Identity. He's also written an article in the latest Touchstone magazine titled Five Rings and a Wedding. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. What's the relationship between divorce, you say easy divorce, weak marriage, and dependence on government, when in no-fault divorce was supposed to be about liberty and freedom? You say, no, it's become more about increasing dependence in society.
Oh, indeed it has. At one level, the growth of the welfare state, the growth of such things as aid to families with dependent children are now covered by a different program called TANF, but welfare payments to single mothers with children, welfare costs associated with health, bad health of children and adults, all are closely tied to divorce or non-marriage, that is, the creation of children outside of marriage. So much of the welfare state's growth has been as a result of the breakdown of families. The average divorce, according to one recent calculation done out in Utah, the average divorce costs the public in the first year somewhere around $40,000 in expenses that the public is going to have to pick up. Everything from poor health to welfare payments to collection of child support payments in the long run, even greater likelihood of incarceration, particularly of the boys who will grow up without fathers in most cases, or without active fathers. So, the growth of the government is closely tied to the weakening of the family and to the spread of non-marriage and of divorce.
Are we really looking at, say, a vacuum that is created by weak marriage, this privatized view of marriage? And that vacuum will be filled by something, government being the most likely candidate.
That's right. There's a what I call sort of a fundamental need for dependence. Every society has to solve the dependency problem. You have people that are too small to take care of themselves, or too old to take care of themselves, or too sick. A strong family solves those problems without forcing the obligations on any public authority. But when families fall apart, the only one you can turn to for help, whether it's need for daycare or need for special medical attention, you turn to the government as the alternative. And so I think you're right. There is a vacuum, and the state stands ready to fill that vacuum at considerable expense.
The fourth concentric ring surrounding marriage, you say, is the community of faith. Tell us about that.
Well, the community of faith relates particularly in the Western Christian tradition. We've had sort of two versions of it. Prior to the Reformation of the 16th century, we had one unified, unitary church which viewed marriage as a Christian sacrament, which viewed divorce as an impossibility. Annulment was possible for invalid marriages, but once you were validly married, you were married for life. And the church, actually, the state was not involved in marriage other than recognizing what the church had done. The church had its own marriage courts to govern disputes, to govern issues of annulment. The Reformation, though, shook that up completely. One of Martin Luther's arguments was that marriage, he could find no grounds for making marriage a sacrament. And so he desacramentalized it, as so to speak. He still was a firm advocate for strong marriage, but he felt it was something that the state should properly govern and control. But he also counted on public figures being motivated and guided by pure Christian principles. So he thought divorce would be possible, although it was only for cases of adultery. And he felt the adulterer should be treated quite severely, not allowed to remarry, and sometimes he even suggested their execution. But he felt the person who had been violated by the adulterer could remarry. But beyond that, he was a very strong advocate for marriage, but he felt it should be turned over to the government to manage and control, you know, to register marriages and to register births.
Now, that functioned pretty well for some time. What brought about the seeds unintentionally planted there came eventually to full fruit? When did this happen?
Well, some of the seeds start to grow in the 19th century. Up until 1850, in England and on all of the American states, to get a divorce was possible, but it required an act of Parliament or an act of the state legislature. So they were rare. It was difficult to get a divorce, and this underscored the public interest in maintaining marriage. That started to break down in the 19th century, and the legislatures turned it over to the court system. We had around 1900, we had the emergence of divorce mills out in the state of Nevada. The silver mines were running out, and so they turned to divorce as a way of making some money, of drawing people to the state. And we saw a steady increase in the divorce rate through the 20th century, really up until about 1946. And what does this testify to? Well, I think it testifies to a weakening of the Christian influence on American life. It was still there, but it was diminishing over time, a growing tendency to turn to secular arguments and to people saying, well, this is hard. It's hard to maintain this marriage. Give us a break. Let us move on and start new lives. And that argument just grew over time. Again, together with places like Nevada, which sort of threw the old protections pretty much out the window 100 years ago.
Alan, you have written this while we're talking about the community of faith. Some now argue that marriage should be completely privatized, that government should get out of the marriage business and return the process to religion. You say, well, this could work in theory. This idea can be safely cast aside. Why so?
Well, just think about how it would work in theory. If the United States had one church, like, say, in medieval Europe, it would work. The government would defer to the church as it had done, say, in 1500, and the church would apply Christian principles to all people and maintain its own courts and have its own, in a sense, its own police powers to enforce its decisions. Or it would work if the government agreed to support the different faith traditions each in their own way. That is, no divorce for Roman Catholics. Among, say, Lutherans, it would mean you could get a divorce only for adultery, but only the violated person in the marriage could remarry. It might mean for, say, the Mormons out west, they believe in eternal marriage, a marriage for all of eternity. That would have to be factored in. Or for Muslims, it would be up to four wives. And you know, the list would go on and on and on, and the government would have to support each church in its different approach to these things. And that obviously isn't going to work very well. what we had before in America, really until the no-fault revolution of the 1960s, was at least an acceptance of what I would call sort of a generic Judeo-Christian view of marriage. And that was thrown out at the same time that things like school prayer were thrown out, at the same time that Roe v. Wade threw out prohibitions on abortion. It was part of a general rejection of the Judeo-Christian roots and assumptions on which our country was built, indirectly, sort of our indirect, unwritten constitution. And we're living with the consequences of that change now.
The fifth concentric ring, and the final one, being the nation as part of the vow of marriage. Of course, now marriage is all the national conversation with the advent of same-sex marriage being seriously considered by some. Does it surprise you that same-sex marriage, given the state of marriage in the way we view it, is now being seriously considered?
Actually, it doesn't surprise me in the least. The problem, as I've sort of hinted at here, is that for 100 and more years, we have been slowly weakening the institution of marriage, stripping it of the expectation of procreation, that is, of creating children, stripping it of its independent power as an institution. What we have left today is a fairly weak institution, easy to get in, easy to get out. It does convey some real benefits in Social Security, in taxation, through employee benefit plans. There's some real benefits attached to marriage. So why wouldn't a homosexual looking out for his or her own interest say, hey, I'd like that too? It doesn't amount to much. There's no the bonds I'm getting into aren't all that tough, but there's some nice benefits attached to it. I mean, it's sort of a logical consequence of the prior weakening that we've allowed to happen to the institution.
Alan Carlson is president of the Howard Center in Rockford, Illinois. Their website, profam.org, profam.org. Alan is also author of several books, including The American Way, Family and Community in the Shaping of American Identity. And he's written an article in the latest Touchstone magazine titled Five Rings and a Wedding. Alan, thank you very much for being our guest.
Well, I've enjoyed it, Todd.
Alan Carlson. When we come back from this break, some audio from the Super Bowl that you didn't hear or see last night, an ad from Ford that was pulled prior to the Super Bowl. We'll find out why it was so controversial, who was objecting, and we'll play a little bit of the ad for you as well. In fact, the ad in its entirety. We'll also hear some more audio from the National Prayer Service, President George W. Bush and Senator Norm Coleman of Minnesota. Both just were having a great time at the National Prayer Breakfast. That's coming up in the next half hour of Issues, Etc. It's open lines for your questions and your comments. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. That's followed by the second hour of the program. We'll be reviewing the latest sermon from D. James Kennedy, the Coral Ridge Hour, a good example of a guy who knows the gospel and eventually, at long last, in the 29th minute of the sermon, gets it out. And then, very subtly, takes it away again. We'll hear that in the second hour of the program. Open Lines is next.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc. How is the Old Testament prophet Joshua a type of Christ? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for February is the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. This commentary focuses on the faithfulness of God, how he kept his covenant promises, and how these promises are fulfilled in Christ. The Concordia Commentary on Joshua is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse on our website at issuesetc.org. Read about the history, culture, and archaeology surrounding the Promised Land in this Concordia Commentary on Joshua. The cost is $42.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. The Concordia Commentary on Joshua, our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February.
Now this Global Minute lets you hear about Carnival. It's a big holiday in Argentina, and each province has its own way of celebrating. Carnival is the wild party that kicks off the Lenten season, which is the traditional period of fasting, beginning about 6 weeks before Easter. Each region has its own way to celebrate. In the northern province of Salta, people dress up and dance the zamba and the carnavalito. In the northeastern provinces, people sing folk songs accompanied by accordions or harps. There are 37 million people in Argentina, a country where good things have happened. Large-scale evangelism during the past 20 years has deeply impacted the nation. Pray Argentinian Christians will remain fervent in their love for Christ and be faithful to spread His word. Blaze a trail where no missionary has ever tread. Learn of unreached peoples using the website missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. This evening at 8 o'clock, the American Cantorai, under the direction of Robert Berkt, will present Beethoven's Mass in C. The concert will be in the chapel of St. Timothy and St. Titus on the campus of Concordia Seminary. An offering will be received, all of which will go to tsunami relief. It's not just tsunami victims who need relief. At different times and in various ways, we all do. Troubled relationships, career difficulties, health or financial problems. If you are a spiritual person, you struggle with your problems in a religious idiom. How does a just God do such things? And why me? The questions Job asked. Relief awaits when you go into a cathedral setting, are still, and hear the music of the church. Not the latest Christian pop from Nashville, but the music of the church that has lived through the ages. If you can come tonight, please do, 8 o'clock, the chapel at Concordia Seminary. But otherwise, close your eyes when you're struggling with a problem. Imagine a sacred setting. Sacred space and sacred music offer relief. Be still and know that I am God. Sacred space and sacred music. When the concert is over, it is well with my soul.
Wake up with inspiration, information, and sing along in the morning with AM 850 KFUO. Hi, this is Paul Clayton with a Christian alternative to Morning Drive Radio. Along with the music, we've got a number of great guests who help you start your day with an encouraging smile on AM 850 KFUO.
Thank you very much.
Is it a sin? Is it a crime? Loving you, dear, like I do.
Oh, sorry. Kids. Ah.
Beyond belief. The new Lincoln Mark LT. Travel well.
There's one Super Bowl ad you didn't see last night. That was actually pulled by Ford in advance of the Super Bowl. And believe me, folks, these are expensive commercials, and they pulled it. Well, here's the story from the AP. Ford, and this is in advance of the Super Bowl, so pardon the tense of the verbs. Ford is dropping one of its Super Bowl ads that show a clergyman finding a set of keys for a new Lincoln, it's a pickup truck, by the way, in the collection plate after church on Sunday morning. A sultry song plays as he walks up to the car, with a singer asking, is it a sin loving you like I do? The man wears a clergyman's collar and tenderly circles the car. Eventually, a little girl and her father come to reclaim the keys. A support group for people abused by priests objected just hours after the ad's release, saying it had sexual overtones and made light of their trauma. A group spokesman said that they're particularly worried about the presence of the little girl and the word lust displayed on a church sign. Ford yanked the ad within hours of hearing the complaint. Now, that was the cleverest part of the ad, as I watched it on the internet, I thought, was at the very end, it's the Lincoln Mark LT, that's the signature of this truck, and at the end, it shows the pastor, the priest, whatever he is, standing at the church signboard with the letters LT in his hand, and then he puts them up on the signboard as the first and the last letters in the word lust. And I thought, wow. Now, I is it just me? But I didn't see anything really problematic in the ad. Now, you might not have seen it. We'll be playing the audio again for you. I'll describe what's going on in the course of open lines, issues, etc. here for the next 25 minutes of the program. Let's listen again to this ad from Ford that was pulled. It was supposed to run during the Super Bowl, and then after the objection of some victims groups in the Priestley abuse scandal, Ford immediately pulled this ad. It's for the Lincoln Mark LT truck. Then I want your feedback on this ad. Call us 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You may not have seen it. You may have only been able to find it on the internet. It is a little difficult to locate. What do you think of the ad? Did it cross the line in associating this? Well, you know, the pastor thinks someone's given me a car in the offering plate. So I'm going to go out and check it out. And he's looking at this thing. It's a beautiful truck. Only to find out it was a mistake. The child accidentally put the keys in the offering plate. And he's left somewhat despondent. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Here's the ad in question again.
See you next week. Thank you very much.
He finds the keys in the plate. Is it a sin? Looking at the truck. Beautiful truck.
Is it a crime? Loving you dear like I do.
Oh, sorry. Kids. Ah.
Beyond belief. The new Lincoln Mark LT. Travel well.
So the owner of the truck comes to reclaim the keys and all is well. Now, the groups that have objected said the inclusion of the little girl in this commercial sends the wrong message. Now, I watched the ad. The guy's lusting after the truck if he's left lusting after anything, not the little girl. What do you think? It's open lines 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Apparently ABC News also ran this ad this morning on television, maybe Friday on television, after Ford had pulled it. So I'm looking at the commercial. Everyone watches these Super Bowl commercials in terms of how clever are they going to be, how funny are they going to be, how groundbreaking are they going to be. I'm anxious to see the one where the wife walks in and catches the guy holding a knife to the cat. I heard about this one. Was it funny, Craig? I didn't watch it. I work on Sunday nights, by the way. It was funny. Okay. But this is the one that got pulled by Ford. Is this just hypersensitivity? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And as usual, during open lines, issues, etc., anything you want to talk about. A little bit later here, as time permits, we'll hear some audio from the National Prayer Breakfast last week, President George W. Bush and his comments, and then a representative from Minnesota, I believe, also chiming in about the spirit and the person of Jesus that was the gathering point for the National Prayer Breakfast. Let's talk first with Greg, who calls from his car. Greg, welcome. Hey, Greg, welcome to the program. Ah, there we go. Greg, welcome.
Hello. Thank you. Okay, can you hear me?
I absolutely can, yes.
Okay, great. I was curious, I've listened to the show, and I was curious if you could tell me if there was any difference between the Lutheran Church and the Church of Christ, not to be confused with the United Church of Christ, just a regular Church of Christ. Would you happen to know it sounds so similar?
So you have checked, apparently you've looked at both, and they sound like they're similar in their teachings?
Right. I've been going to a Church of Christ for about a year now, and then I listened on the radio, and a lot of these things that you bring up, I hear, you know, at my church, and I was wondering why they're so similar.
A couple of things before I let you go here, Greg. What are the points of similarity, if you could give me some specifics to work with? And is this a Campbellite Church
sure.
of Christ, do you know?
I'm not sure what Campbellite would mean.
All right. What are the points of similarity that you're detecting here?
Well, we really are, you know, speaking of a lot of different sermons that you hear on the radio, and, you know, and they don't bring up Christ, you know, as you point out on so many of these other, what I would call false teachers, how they just, you know, more like inspirational speakers rather than gospel preachers. That reminds me a lot of what I hear on Sundays, but it's hard to remember a lot of things, but I've been listening for about a month now, so a lot of stuff that you say, I hear, you know, on Sundays, and I'm just curious if you knew of any differences.
Okay, thank you very much, Greg. Well, off the top of my head, I could probably point out a few differences. And this is going to perhaps require listening beyond the sermon on Sunday morning. Because if you're hearing an emphasis on a Christ and Him crucified, oh, that is great. I'm very glad to hear that you're hearing that in a Church of Christ. Very glad to hear that. If you're hearing an emphasis on the cross of Jesus Christ, great. There will be some significant differences. And these are questions you want to ask your pastor, Greg. Two things. First of all, ask your pastor about something as simple as baptism. What is baptism? Or ask the question this: what does Scripture teach us baptism is? Now, here's a basic difference that you might discover. Your pastor might say, well, baptism is an ordinance that God has given us to perform, to obey as believers, as a sign, an outward sign, but merely a symbol of an inward conviction, change, faith, whatever it may be. That's very different from what Lutherans believe. The Lutheran confessions, along with Scripture, teach that baptism is not merely an outward symbol of an inward change or conviction or faith, but it is in fact, it's not an ordinance that God has given us to perform at all. It's an ordinance, in fact, it's an institution from God, which God performs, albeit through human means, but God performs in order to create faith in unbelievers. And when believers are baptized, it is a confirmation of what God has already done through His Word, which is the active element there in baptism as well. It is a physical means for the proclamation of the Word of the Gospel, which is the power of God unto salvation for all who believe. Now, that might be one difference. Another difference might be on the Lord's Supper. Again, what is it? What does Scripture teach us it is? Is it, again, an outward ordinance that we do in order to symbolize something? Something it isn't something itself, it's just a symbol of something else. Well, that might be the answer you get from your pastor. Or is it, as Scripture teaches and Lutherans believe, in fact, what God does to deliver something real to us, not just a symbol of something else, but the thing itself, that is Christ's body and blood with the bread and wine to be eaten and drunk for the forgiveness of sins. Another means by which God delivers the benefits of Christ's cross to us for the forgiveness of sins. Some other issues: does unconverted man have a free will when it comes to matters spiritual? Is his will entirely bound by sin so that he cannot make a move spiritually prior to God creating faith? Is faith God's work, or is it something man conjures up? Some basic things. Now, those are kind of the heart of the matter there. When Jesus said, "It is finished," at the cross, does that leave something left undone for us to do to complete the transaction of salvation? Our decision, an act of our will, our commitment, giving our life to Jesus. Or when Jesus says, "It is finished," is He proclaiming once and for all the full redemption of all sinners? And that with the proclamation of His death and resurrection, sinners are converted by God into believers. A few things. The other thing I'd suggest you do is go to a Lutheran church and listen carefully there. Now, be on your guard. Not every Lutheran church will clearly profess what it is Lutherans believe. So you might have to do a little searching to find one that does. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And Greg mentioned the preachers who kind of preach just a self-help, happy, smiling, let's feel better about ourselves type of a gospel. That's coming up a little bit later in the very last half hour of Issues, Etc., when we hear an NBC Today program. They did a feature this last week on Joel Osteen. Barry is calling from his car. Barry, welcome.
Thank you, Pastor. Happened to see the ad you were talking about for the Ford truck, and the morning news show was showing some of the ones that had been pulled, and they set it up that, you know, Snap had voiced their concerns about the ad, and so then they, showed the ad, and I kind of sat there perplexed at what the problem was. I didn't understand, and I hear what you're saying about the little girl being there, but it seemed a bit of a stretch to me when I saw it. So I didn't get what Snap was so concerned about. So I just thought I'd throw in my viewpoint since
okay.
I did see it.
Thank you, Barry. That was my reaction. What's the big deal here? Granted, someone could, if they were watching with the sound down, kind of half paying attention, think, what was that? There's a guy in a collar, and there was a little girl, and somehow make an association. But you watch the ad, I think they did a good job of kind of saying the girl put the keys in the collection plate, the dad comes to retrieve the keys, and the pastor, who had thought perhaps someone was leaving him this truck as an offering, is disappointed. I don't know. Brant is calling from St. Louis. Brant, welcome to Issues, Etc. Brant, welcome. All right, we'll get Brant back if he wants to call back. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I don't know. I think hypersensitivity. Had the guy not been wearing a collar, maybe he had been dressed like a Baptist minister. How do you communicate that in an ad? You give him a pompadour and a shiny suit. I mean, how do you make him look like a Christian minister unless maybe have a cross hanging around his neck, something like that? Maybe that wouldn't have raised the questions there. It's open lines. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Today, millions of people across this earth get the help they need only because our faith-based institutions live the commandment to love thy neighbor as thyself.
That was President George W. Bush speaking at last week's National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, D.C. The emphasis there was on the president's faith-based initiatives. That is his goal for a gathering like this, and I think it was several thousand who gathered in Washington, D.C. for this big event. It's an annual event. And then there are smaller events that take place in communities locally on the same day. Maybe you went to one of these last week. We talked a bit about the National Prayer Breakfast and the other prayer breakfasts that take place. And I asked the question, what's going on at one of these things? We heard from Senator Rick Santorum, who was a participant in the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, D.C. last week. And he talked about being gathered in the Spirit of Jesus. And I was a little mystified by that because this was a gathering of all religions, not just Christians. Maybe predominantly Christians, maybe a majority of the people there were Christians in some sense, but not exclusively a Christian gathering. So I was a little mystified by Santorum's characterization that this was a gathering in the Spirit of Jesus. Maybe the Spirit of Jesus in only the broadest sense, and even that would need some definition. President Bush also said that faith itself motivates outreach to those who are in desperate need in society.
These great moral challenges of our times, our churches, synagogues, mosques, and temples are providing the vision that is changing lives.
What is the vision, though? Because he does lump together churches, synagogues, mosques, and temples into one group. And that's not a problem if we're simply talking about that religion in general in American society, religion in general has a goal of helping people who are, one of its goals, among others, a goal of helping people who are in desperate need. That's fine. That's fine. That's an entirely different thing than, because we can always gather together to help the poor. I mean, Christians, Mormons, Muslims, Jews, in order to help people in our society who have been cut out or fallen through the cracks, we can gather together and pool our money and do all sorts of things like that without agreeing that our theology has to be mashed down or shoehorned into a one-size-fits-all, all roads lead to God type of a thing. Now, that's different, and I pointed this out last week, that's different than everyone getting together and praying together. So where's the misperception? We had someone call last week who said, look, if I'm praying to the triune God as a Christian at one of these events, and the guy next to me, say a Jew or a Muslim, is praying to their God, and I believe it's a false God, but their God at one of these events, but I'm, in my own heart, got a right understanding of what's going on here in my prayer, what's the harm? Now, I mentioned in response to that call, the harm might be that your neighbor sitting next to you, he's praying to his God, gets the distinct impression that it's the same God. Another participant at the National Prayer Breakfast last week was Senator Norm Coleman of Minnesota. Now, he says he's in a weekly Bible study with senators who are Christians.
We share our joys and griefs with each other. We listen deeply, and we pray for the work of the Senate, and the nation, and the world. And we meet around the person and principles of Jesus. Republicans, Democrats, Catholics, Baptists, Jews, men and women.
A person and, here it is again, the person and work, or no, principles of Jesus. Now, this is a Jewish senator, Norm Coleman of Minnesota, who's talking about the gathering that he has with Christian senators, and that they gather around the person and principles of Jesus. Something, a little rule of thumb, something might be missing if a Jewish senator can attend your Bible study and can walk away saying, you know, I really appreciate that Jesus guy even more than I did before. Something might be missing. Now, I'm not saying that they can't appreciate the teachings of Jesus, but that's not what Jesus is all about, right? His person and his principles are not what Jesus is all about for the Christian. Something might be missing in your Bible study if you're studying the Bible and you even talk about the person and principles of Jesus, and a Jewish participant can walk away saying, you know, I really got no problem with that Jesus. You know what might be missing? The cross. The scandal of the cross. The stumbling block of the cross. And yet here's Senator Coleman saying that he appreciates Jesus too.
As a Jew, I'm learning a lot of new things which challenge me. I have a profound respect for the tangibility and accessibility of God that my colleagues find in Jesus.
Now, he respects the fact that they find a tangible and accessible God in Jesus. This might be a very broad-minded understanding that, oh, I wonder if the Christian senators would return the compliment. I'm wondering, okay, could they say, well, and we have gained a better appreciation understanding that Senator Coleman has of the tangibility and accessibility of God through his keeping of the Old Testament law. Now, see, one of these ways to God actually leads to God, that is, Jesus Christ, his perfect life, death, and resurrection, if that's being mentioned at all. The other one doesn't. Our keeping of the Old Testament law, or any law for that matter, doesn't lead to God. God is no more tangible or accessible through our obedience than he is through, and whether you're Jew, Christian, whatever you are, than he is through the obedience that pagans render to their false gods. I'm still mystified by this National Prayer Breakfast. Actually, I'm not so mystified. I know what I'm looking at. I'm looking at American civil religion. This is religion that is pared down in the interests of the state. This is religion with a political purpose. In religion in service of the state. Anne is calling from Crestwood. Anne, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Oh, good afternoon, Pastor. And I wanted to comment on the commercial with the lusting priest.
Yes.
I found that, I mean, when I have seen it once, and I just, the first reaction was, whoa, why are they going there? I did not think it was funny, and I guess I grew up with one of the first priests that was totally defrocked was in the parish where I grew up, and was, my brothers were altar boys under him. Not that he did anything to them, but I just find the whole subject, I thought it was in poor taste completely. Okay. I was glad it was withdrawn.
Now, you saw the ad?
Yeah, just, it was a demonstration of the commercials that were pulled from the game.
I got the, maybe this is just me as a guy, I got the distinct impression that he was, if anything, he was lusting after the truck.
Well, absolutely, but the whole idea of priests and lusting after the things that have gone on the past few years, I just thought it was in pretty bad taste.
Okay, so you thought it did cross a line because it made, and it, what if the commercial had not ended with him holding the LT letters and putting them on the signboard to form the first and the last letters of the word lust?
I don't know. I don't even remember that part of the commercial. Just the idea of this guy hovering over this car and lusting for it just seemed really in bad taste, in my estimation.
Okay,
lusting for anything at this point after the past few years.
Had it been the typical kind of picture of the evangelical minister, not the collared minister, but had it been a guy with a pompadour and a cheap suit and a cross hanging around his neck?
Well,
to kind of send the message, here's your average Protestant minister. Had it been that, would you have been struck the same way?
Well, it's still making fun of these people, and it's still pointing at lusting, and I don't know. Why go there? It's offensive.
All right.
And I mean, maybe you can even chuckle at it, but still in all, I don't know.
Had there been no kid in the act?
I don't even remember the little girl. All I remember is I didn't see the whole thing, possibly. I remember this guy hovering over this car, okay, panting for this car.
All right, Ann, thank you. You know, the funny thing is, well, you know what I was reminded of when I watched this? Was coming out of church, I think it was, in fact, at the church that Ann might even attend, and one of the leaders of the church, not the pastor, one of the leaders of the church, was driving, and he was leaving. I was going to my car. He was driving one of the new Thunderbirds. Now, those, you'll find Pastor Wilkin hovering over a Thunderbird as often as he can find one. And he pulls up, and it's one of these black ones. It's got the tan rag top. It's got the tan leather interior. And he pulls up, and I said, "This is a sweet vehicle. Are you happy with it?" Of course, that's kind of a rhetorical question when you see a man driving a Thunderbird convertible. Of course, he's happy with it. And we talked a bit about, you know, through the open car window, about how I like the fact that they brought kind of the retro look back. It still is a very modern car. It's very sleek, and it is reminiscent of the car that every young teenage boy dreamt they could someday own. The old original Thunderbird with the little round window in the back. That's what I was reminded of. Now, I get Ann's point, being that after everything that's happened, maybe you don't want to go there. But finding a specific connection, in bad taste, I'll go that far with Ann, perhaps, but someone finding a specific connection between that and the priestly abuse scandal, still seems like a stretch to me. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We're going to a break. When we come back, we've got open lines continuing, but the subject will change. We're going to pick up on a sermon from D. James Kennedy, his latest sermon from the Coral Ridge Hour. It is, in fact, a repeat sermon. Now, it's not a repeat broadcast, it's a repeat sermon. At the outset of this sermon on Lincoln, asking the question, was Abraham Lincoln a Christian? D. James Kennedy is going to seek to answer that question in the course of this sermon. He will say that this is a sermon that he preached 4 or 5 years ago on the occasion of Lincoln's birthday. We're going to hear that sermon. It's a good example of someone who knows the gospel, and there in the 29th minute of his sermon finally gets it out, and then quite promptly and subtly takes it away again. You'll hear what I mean when we come back with the next hour of Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.